be at BI. And to honor the occasion, I'll talk about some so far unpublished work with Miguel Paulos and Alessandro Vicky, who are both at CERN right now. So today's talk will be about logarithmic conformal field theories, which are not very well known to most of us, so I'll try to be reasonably pedagogical. And if you have questions, of course, don't hesitate to interrupt at any point. Okay, so my talk will roughly have three parts. I'll start by explaining what these logarithmic conformal field theories are, and especially where they occur in interesting physical systems. Then I'll try to set up some new technology that we can use to deal with them, so mostly to analyze their correlation functions. In the final part of this talk, I'll actually address the question of whether there exists a bottom-up approach to study them. So does the conformal bootstrap extend to these logarithmic theories? I won't talk too much about the normal CFT technology today, so I'll just go over this CFT stuff in one slide, I hope. For particle physicists, conformal field theories are fixed points of the renormalization group, or if you're in statistical physics, then you think of them as critical points in phase diagrams. They're, of course, very rich QFTs, so they have not only the Poincaré symmetry, but they have no mass or length scale associated to them, which means that there is a dilatation invariance. And finally, generically, you get a number of extra symmetries for free, so these generate something called special conformal transformations. Normally, we're interested in local observables in these CFTs, so correlation functions. And they're not correlation functions of, say, just a field in Lagrangian, but of a general composite operator. These have a lot of quantum numbers, so they have some Lorentz spin. They may have some quantum numbers associated to some global symmetry group. But today, the most interesting quantum number will be the scaling dimension delta, which tells you how such a composite operator transforms under rescaling. And once you know these quantum numbers, you can start studying what conformal symmetry tells you about the correlation functions themselves. So if you take two different operators, OI, you try to construct their two-point function, you'll see that if the fields are different, this two-point function will be zero. If they're identical, then there's a simple power law that's governed by the scaling dimension. You can play a similar game for three-point functions. So you can take three different fields, OI, OJ, OK. And conformal symmetry in this case tells you that this three-point function will be a product of three power laws with the powers themselves fixed in terms of the scaling dimensions up to an overall constant, which I call CIJK. And some people call this an OPE coefficient. And it's a theorem of CFT that these two numbers, so on the one hand, the set of scaling dimensions delta, on the other hand, these three-point coefficients, CIJK, together they are all the interesting local information that you can learn from a CFT. So they are the object of study for the rest of this talk. There's also an interesting twist to this story. So there is an extra set of consistency condition that comes from studying four-point functions in CFTs. I won't work out their precise form today, but the essential idea is that they are infinite sums. They're sums over all operators in the theory. And they're quadratic in these OPE coefficients. So at the dots, I'm hiding some special functions that I'll get to later in this talk. So this is a very simple way to decide whether a set of these coefficients CIJK defines a viable QFT, yes or no. If this equation is satisfied, then it's a possible CFT. If it's not satisfied, then you can rule out the set of three-point functions as a reasonable theory. And it's called the conformal bootstrap, or the bootstrap principle. So it's something that should work in theory, but it turns out it's also practically useful. So here, for example, I'm showing a recent plot that was done by Philip Koss, David Poland, and David Simmons Duffin. You should read this plot roughly in the following way. So on the x-axis and the y-axis, you see two scaling dimensions, or critical exponents. And essentially what these guys are doing, they're scanning over the landscape of all possible theories. And for every point, they decide, well, is there a solution to this system, yes or no? So the white areas, I hope you can see it on this plot, most of the plot is white, is ruled out. So there's no possible CFT with these scaling dimensions. But the blue areas do define possible CFTs. So the most interesting point in this plot is this small blue island. And it turns out that this precisely corresponds to a 3D easing model. So if you flip the logic, then you could use this bootstrap method to make a very precise prediction about the critical exponents in the easing model without knowing anything else about the theory. So without appealing to Lagrangians or lattices, whatever. So it's a standalone method to make predictions in some cases. And now, unfortunately, I have to backtrack already. So I have to correct something I said before. Namely, in general, CFTs cannot be only power laws. In some cases, correlation functions are a product of power laws, but there are also a number of logarithms involved. So that seems to be a problem, because if you look at how these logarithms transform under rescalings, then they don't have a simple behavior. So there must be some extra ingredient. And this ingredient can actually comes from the renormalization group. So if you think about how you normally compute these scaling dimensions, then you compute the matrix of anomalous dimensions and you diagonalize it. And the eigenvalues of the matrix of anomalous dimensions correspond to scaling dimensions. At least in perturbation theory, you've done this exercise at some point probably. But there can be a pathological case. So if this matrix of anomalous dimensions cannot be diagonalized, then you have a problem. In that case, there will always be some kind of irreducible mixing between different operators. And mathematically, that's when that happens, you have a number of Jordan blocks that are left in this matrix. So these are, that's a mathematical fact of life. And we'll have to deal with this in the rest of this talk. I want to say one thing, namely that these Jordan blocks are not generic. So in a normal CFT, if you diagonalize a matrix, the matrix of anomalous dimensions, then you expect the eigenvalues to be separated. So they're random numbers, but there's at least a gap between them. And these Jordan blocks can only occur when two eigenvalues really collide. So they're precisely the same. So there's a kind of degeneracy in the spectrum. And there's another thing that's, whenever there are these logs, there must be some kind of RG scale that's left in them, because a log cannot be dimensionful. So roughly what this means is when you change this renormalization group scale, then you slightly change the observables, but you can compensate this by rotation in the field space. So it's not an interesting thing. So from now on, we can just set this scale to 1, and we won't worry about it anymore. But it's something to keep in mind if you compare to actual data. At this point, I think I want to discuss some of the interesting examples of these logarithmic CFTs. Well, for one, they're not very simple to generate, for simple reason that these logarithms violate unitarity. So if you start with what I call here a vanilla QFT, so a theory of bosons and fermions with real couplings, you will never be able to flow to such a log CFT. So you must have some extra ingredient. And in statistical physics, there are many examples of this. So there's a very generic way of constructing them. And what happens is there are limits of a family of CFTs. And often these families are not completely well-defined. So maybe they're non-unitary themselves. And for one fine-tuning, you arrive at one of these log CFTs. So one interesting example is percolation, which I hope most of us are familiar with. So this is a problem about clusters on the lattice. And it turns out that you can rephrase percolation as a Potts model, also on the lattice. So the Potts model itself is a generalization of the easing model. And it turns out that it's a generalization with a label Q, and Q counts the number of states that the spin, say essentially the easing spin, can have. So Q equals 2 would correspond to the normal easing model. And it turns out that if you take the limit Q goes to 1, you arrive at percolation. And some care must be taken when doing this limit, because Q equals 1 is a spin system with only one state, so it's a completely trivial model. But if you take this limit carefully, then you do end up with a very non-trivial theory. And there's also a way to explain the degeneracies in the spectrum. So these degeneracies always have to do with group theory, representation theory. Recently, there's been some work by Jacobs and Soler and Vasseur who have really cataloged this group theory behavior that gives rise to logs. So it's a very simple case here. You'd have two observables on the lattice, one field that is 1 if, so it has a label of the global symmetry group, of the permutation group SQ. It's 1 if the color of the spin field is equal to A, and zero otherwise, but you subtract a finite piece because you need to work with irreducible representations. And some of these irreducible representations collide when you take these limits. So when q goes to zero, for example, there's a mixing between two of these lattice operators. And if these are, of course, well, only defined on the lattice, but it turns out that you can coarse grain. So and you end up also in the continuum theory with well-defined operators. And q goes to zero is, of course, not percolation, but you can extend this problem and go to more complicated looking tensor operators that will become degenerate for percolation. There are more families of examples. Another well-known one is self-avoiding walks. So again, this is a non-local problem. It doesn't have a transfer matrix formulation, but it can be mapped on the lattice to the ON model, or the Heisenberg model, however you want to call it. And again, you need to take a funny limit, namely where n, so the dimension of the spin field, goes to zero. So by itself, this doesn't define a useful quantum field theory, but in this limiting sense, it does give rise to a non-local CFT. And you can also have another class of examples is furnished by disorder. So this is a case where you can kind of integrate out this disorder when you consider n copies of the same system, and then take the limit where n goes to zero. So this is called the replica trick. Okay, so there are a few important things about these examples, namely that they are very generic. They only depend on group theory. They don't depend on the precise microscopic description of your system. And this allows you to argue that this is not just a two-dimensional phenomenon, but you expect these log CFTs to arise for a whole interval of dimensions. So for example, the Potts model is interacting. It defines a critical point for all dimensions below 6. So in particular, for 3D, 4D, and 5D, you expect to be able to have a percolating interacting point. It would be interesting to study.
So is this log that shows up in like a two-point function, is that just like, is that the same as when you're trying to define a renormalized two-point function for a well-unregulated one for like special values of delta? Like if you have delta equal to d over 2 and you want to make sure it's like a well-defined, you know, distribution, you have these log terms that show up to kind of regulate divergences. Is that the same thing?
No, this is, that's kind of an artifact of the renormalization group. So one more familiar example is, for example, when you're working in perturbation theory, then you can have logs that you need to resum, right? So you can get and the resummation of these logs gives rise to an anomalous dimension. But this is really some irreducible log that's, yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't just arise in.
And did you say you have to have like two operators that have the same scale?
Yeah. So there's at least two operators. You can have more complicated cells. And there's also some recent work for the bootstrap experts. So there was a paper by Hikami and Shimada, who analyzed the ON model, which in three dimensions, which for integer values of n is completely well defined. But in the bootstrap equations, n only appears as just a parameter. So you can set n to any value you like, in particular 0.5, 0.2, 0.1. You can hope that by extrapolating, you can get a reasonable prediction for n equals to 0. And indeed, you get some nice results. So I urge you all to consider this paper. But there is a small problem with this procedure, namely that the ON model is only unitary if n is an integer. So in particular, if you tune n away from 1, then you will get some unitarity violations. And in particular, as n becomes very close to 0, then you know that this normal bootstrap procedure should fail. And indeed, that's what they find, that you get some technical complications if you try to make n very small. So if you want to refine this work, then you'd really need to take these logarithms into account. Okay, I can say a few things about what has already been done in two dimensions. So there, the conformal symmetry is much more constraining. And there are like two things that I want to highlight. So one thing is that there's a way to extend the normal minimal models to make them logarithmic minimal models, or extended or augmented minimal models, depending on which papers you read. These models are much more intricate and subtle than normal minimal models, so they have an infinite number of Yuro-Soro families, whereas the normal minimal models have a finite CATS table. But on the other hand, they have a richer symmetry group, so every one of these logarithmic minimal models has a W extension, which gives you some extra control. So a lot of work has gone into studying the representation theory, the Verma modules of these log minimal models. And also there are some approaches based on integrability, so on studying lattice systems that mimics the algebraic structure that you expect. So you can already see the Jordan blocks for finite lattices. And this gives you a very concrete way to study things like fusion rules or study the spectrum. And this has been used to generate to predict some actual numbers. But there are two problems still in 2D, essentially. On the one hand, the classification of such CFTs is still an open problem, so it's, which for the unitary case is, of course, solved. And on the other hand, bulk physics. So if you really want to compute correlation functions that not only have a chiral part, but both a chiral and an anti-chiral part, that's also a very challenging problem. So it's difficult to glue the left and right movers together to get a physical correlation function. And we, of course, in the rest of this talk, want to go even further. We won't just want to study two dimensions, but any number of dimensions. So there's a nice sequence of problems that we should solve. First of all, we should analyze 2- and 3-point functions and try to see if these numbers, C, I, J, K, these OPE coefficients, have an analog in logarithmic CFTs. We should see if there's a consistency condition coming from 4-point functions. And finally, we will hope to assemble this into some kind of bootstrap algorithm. And I should say at this point, there has been some work before on analyzing this correlation function in 2 dimensions mostly, so based on the global conformal group. And you should read the review by Floor if you want to see kind of the state of the art in this respect. But most of what I'm going to say from now on is new work. I won't, of course, go through the technical details, but there's one key idea when you analyze these log CFTs, namely that there's always a multiplet of fields that give rise to this logarithmic behavior. So the simplest non-trivial case is that of rank 2. So you have two fields, O1 and O2, that form a vector of operators. And under the transformation laws, there is some kind of mixing between them that's governed precisely by these Jordan blocks. So this would be the simplest case where you have two scalar operators. All the transformation laws are the same, except for dilatations. And you can generalize, of course, to higher spin or more complicated Jordan blocks, but this is the essential idea. And there's another useful tool, namely that the bottom component of such a multiplet transforms as it would in a normal CFT. So in this case, O2, you see if you kind of exponentiate this matrix, you'll see that it transforms under dilatations as it would in a normal CFT. But O1, the top component, has the usual term plus some extra logarithmic correction. So from now on, we'll just have to do the bookkeeping to make sure that the correlation functions respect these extra terms that come in. The simplest case of interest will be that of 2-point functions. So I'll try to at least walk you through the logic of the 2-point functions. So here I'm considering a 2-point function of a rank 2 field. So this is a scalar field of dimension delta that comes in such a Jordan block. And we want to study the 2-point functions. So A and B label the states in the multiplet, so they can take the values 1 or 2. And this means that such a correlation function is not a number, it's a matrix. It's a matrix of correlation functions, which I call B. Just by Lorentz invariance, it can only depend on the difference. And of course, of the norm of the difference between the 2 points, so x squared in this case. And I already pulled out a factor x to 2 delta to compensate for the normal scaling behavior, because this is what you get in a normal CFT. So then you start turning the crank. You analyze the Ward identities, or infinitesimal transformations of these operators. And you find that the most general solution to them is of this form. So B is a matrix that depends on 2 constants. K1 and K2. It has a 0 in the rightmost corner, so the correlation function phi 2 is always 0. It cannot have an arbitrary value. And there's a logarithm that we did not put in by hand, but it's really a solution of a system of equations. So it's forced upon you by the Ward identities. But if you look at this, then, well, you would think that it really depends on 2 parameters. But fortunately, there is some extra simplification that depends on the value of the parameters. So in a pathological case, it can happen that k2 is 0. And if that's the case, then you can show that this operator phi 2, that it decouples from the theory completely. So it's kind of an uninteresting case, and you can treat it separately. But whenever k2 is non-zero, then there's a nice redefinition of the fields. So you can define the first field phi 1, redefine the first field phi 1. And if you do this change of basis, then the matrix takes a simpler form. And you can pull out an overall constant that I call k phi here. So that's the main lesson, that these two-point functions only depend on one constant. In a normal CFT, you want to rescale the field to make this constant 1, because that's what happens in a unitary theory. But for log CFTs, that doesn't make much sense, because you can show that unitarity is violated regardless of the sign of k. So whether k is plus 1 or minus 1, neither of them really is physically justifiable, so you can make it any value you like. So from now on, we can just leave this constant k as some arbitrary coefficient, as long as it's not 0. Yeah, so, you already know the embedding space then. So the trick is that the embedding space transformations are precisely this, so they have just one extra term. So you can either, yeah, that's one way of determining these wired identities that's, in fact, simpler than doing it in normal flat space. But no, so in the embedding space, it would there's still a logarithm, but of, well, coordinates in the, of these embedding space coordinates. I mean, I derived this using the normal formalism, but yeah, it does work. Okay, so if that's solved, we'll study something more interesting, but also more difficult, namely three-point functions. So there's some notation to explain here. I consider a three-point function of three essentially different fields. So the different fields are labeled by I, J, and K. And they also all have a logarithmic label, A, B, and C. So these, again, label which states they are inside the logarithmic multiplets. So if these are rank 2 fields, then A, B, and C can take the values 1 or 2. Well, there will be some scale factor, as in a normal CFT that I just factor out for simplicity. And overall, there will be some matrix or tensor with three labels that's left. And there can be some x dependence inside this matrix. So what can conformal symmetry tell us about this matrix KABC? Well, already it's clear that it's not completely trivial if you look at one of the few solved examples of logarithmic CFTs. So this is the so-called triplet model in two dimensions, which was solved by Gaberdiel and Kausch. If you look at a three-point function, and you see that it's a sum of four different structures. So it's a pure number here, as you would expect in a normal CFT. But then there are three logarithmic structures. So all of them are sums over products of logarithms. So the question is, of course, what is the physics behind such a form? Is there some kind of irreducible information? And what can we learn about them? Well, we play the same game as before. We study the wired identities and try to solve them. But this becomes very messy if you just work with the coordinates x1 minus x2, x2 minus x3, etc. So it will be very useful to introduce some more refined coordinates that I call sigma I here. So sigma 1 is a certain ratio of log, it's a log of a ratio of the x's. And sigma 2 and sigma 3 are cyclic permutations. And they have two nice properties. On the one hand, they transform, as you'd expect, under permutations of the x's. So they're symmetric in some sense, and they also transform nicely under conformal transformations. Indeed, if you look at the wired identities, then you see that there are differential equations that relate these different matrix elements. They take a very simple form in these sigma coordinates. So KABC, the derivative with respect to sigma 1 of KABC is equal to KA plus 1 BC. And likewise for the second and third indices. So you hope to find a simple solution of them. And on very general grounds, you can say that the solution will be a polynomial in these sigmas up to, well, where the rank of the polynomial, of course, depends on the details of the problem that you're studying. So here, let me consider the simplest case that you can imagine, one where the three fields are identical, and in a rank, two things. So A, B, and C can take the values 1 or 2. So there are essentially 8 matrix elements that we need to determine. And now I want you to recall the statement that the bottom component of such a multiple transforms as it would in a normal CFT. So in particular, the phi 2 three-point function, it takes its normal form, so it can only be a pure number, which I call C4. But if you start inserting more of these logarithmic partner fields, phi 1, you get more and more complicated answers. So they will depend on more and more logarithms. Indeed, it's what you see here. So K222 is a pure number. But if you go all the way down to the most complicated one, K111, so the three-point function phi 1, phi 1, phi 1, then it's a sum of 4 terms. So it depends on 4 constants, C1 up to C4. And they multiply some symmetric polynomials in these sigmas. It is what it is, but it's not very complicated if you look at it this way. So it seems like a tractable thing. And the thing to keep in mind is that there's just a finite number of, this is the case of 3 identical fields. But even if you generalize to 3 different fields, there's always just a finite number of coefficients that is left undetermined by the conformal symmetry. And at this point, at least the CFT experts will ask what happens to the OPE. So in every CFT, there's a short distance expansion known as the operator product expansion. So it means that if you take 2 fields, then you can replace them by sum over operators with suitable coefficients. Normally, those are the CIJKs. In a logarithmic CFT, you can show that there's still such a thing as the OPE. Radial quantization still works. But rather than just having simply these numbers CIJK, there are more complicated formulas that involve these coefficients that we derived here. But the take-home message is there's still a one-to-one mapping between three-point functions and OPEs. And that's already a promising result because it shows that there's some glimmer of hope that you could write down some bootstrap equations. Okay. So at this point, we should really get to work to some more complicated problem, namely that of 4-point functions. Already in a normal CFT, 4-point functions are non-trivial. So they depend on some kind of scale factor, as did the 3-point functions, something of this form. But they also depend on 2 coordinates that are not fixed by conformal symmetry, U and V. So they're conformal invariants or cross ratios. And they're 2 things that you can build out of the different x's. There's no constraint coming from conformal symmetry. There's only 1 constraint. So there's an arbitrary function of 2 variables left. And in some cases, there's an additional constraint of such a function. So here we're interested in a 4-point function of identical fields. In this case, of course, if you swap 2 of the fields, then you should get the same 4-point function back, since we're studying Euclidean correlation functions. So there are no subtleties with respect to time ordering or something. So in this case, you can show that if you exchange these coordinates in all different ways, then you find 2 non-trivial constraints on such a function f. So one of them is that f of u and v equals f of v and u. So you can just swap the coordinates and you get back the same function. And another one that looks a bit uglier is that f of u and v equals f of u over v and 1 over v. It is what it is. I cannot make the equations more beautiful than they are. And ultimately, this is what's called a crossing symmetry relation. This is what underlies the power of this conformal bootstrap. Okay, but then you start looking at examples of real-life logarithmic CFTs, and you get quickly discouraged. So again, let's look at the 4-point function that was found by Gabordy and Kausch. So now it's a sum of many different terms. And in this case, I think there are 7 different logarithmic structures. So the worst possible case is a kind of a cubic sums of logarithms, and all of them have different numerical coefficients. So in this particular case, of course, you would see that crossing symmetry is respected. If you exchange x1 and x2, you get back the same number. But it's very unclear how this generalizes. And especially, it's not only a function of u and v. It's a more complicated thing. So well, one wonders what if there's some kind of resolution to this. And again, we can study the Ward identities, but this time it will take us some extra work. So again, for simplicity, let's look at a four-point function of identical fields that come in a rank 2 multiplet. Well, of course, there will be some kind of scale factor that we can factor out. And then there will be some kind of tensor or matrix F, A, B, C, D with four indices that we need to determine. And it will depend on U and V, but also on any number of extra parameters. So if you count based on Lorentz invariants, you can build 6 invariants, so you need 4 extra coefficients, 4 extra parameters. So what's an economic choice? It turns out that there's really one that stands out. So there's one that is the most symmetrical of all, and that's what I call here tau parameters. So they're something that naturally generalizes the sigmas that occurred in three-point functions. So they're quite complicated looking combination of the logs. And here I only write down T1, but the rest is a cyclic permutation. But again, they have two nice properties. So they transform simply under permutations, even though it's not completely trivial if you look at the formulas, but you can show that they do. And again, they transform simply under conformal transformation. So tau1 just transforms with a scale factor at x1, for example. And okay, at this point you can start computing the Ward identities. And indeed, if you're careful, then you see that these variables really disentangle the different Ward identities. So the derivative of F A B C D with respect to tau1 is equal to F A plus 1 B C D, and likewise for the other guys. So it's a not too complicated system of differential equations that you can solve. And as with the three-point functions, you know that the solution of these Ward identities will be a polynomial in the taus with the rank depending on the rank of the fields phi. And essentially, that's all you can say at this point. So then you start solving the problem. And at this point, it's very important to take into account that you're not just looking for matrix elements that are invariant under the conformal symmetry, but they're also invariant under permutation symmetry. So if you exchange two of the fields, you should get back the same four-point function. The real result is a bit ugly looking, but there are still some things you can say. So as before, the bottom component of such a multiplet transforms like a normal scalar. So the phi 2 four-point function is just a function that depends on u and v, which I call f5. And the things get more complicated as you look at phi 1. So you can stare at the structure a lot. But the most important conclusion is that all of this, even though it's ugly looking, it depends on 5 functions, f1, f2, et cetera, up to f5 of u and v. And there are some logarithms that come in predictable patterns. So in this case, you see that these taus, they only occur in symmetric polynomials. And then there's an even more magical result, namely that these f functions by themselves obey crossing relations. So normally in the four-point function, it would be the whole thing that obeys a crossing relation. In a logarithmic CFT, maybe even if you look at this system, you would expect that there are very complicated crossing relations between that mix the different f functions. But there's a miracle that happens. And at the end of the day, these functions by themselves obey all the crossing relations. And only f3 only obeys one of the two, but that's a detail. So this is a very hopeful result, because it shows that despite these very complicated correlation functions, that there are simple crossing relations, and we can hope to bootstrap something. And I should also say that this is, of course, for one example. You can consider mixed correlation functions of, say, where two of the insertions are logarithmic fields and two are normal fields, and the same machinery applies. But this is kind of the simplest non-trivial case. Okay, so we're halfway there at this point, and I hope that you're at least a little bit optimistic that there's a conformal bootstrap for logarithmic CFTs. So the final thing that you need to put in place is to kind of expand these four-point functions in terms of partial waves. So you have these functions F1 up to F5, and you want to express them in terms of these three-point function coefficients. In a normal CFT, that's a well-known result. So you see this function F is a sum over all operators in the theory with these three-point function coefficients squared appearing. That's a crucial thing. And they multiply some function, which is called a conformal block, which depends on these two cross ratios. These conformal blocks, I won't specify them in detail here. They're not so important. What's important is their universal objects, so they only depend on the quantum numbers of the states involved. And we can compute them whenever we like. So they're tabulated. And for logarithmic CFTs, roughly the same applies, but there are many more details. So it's difficult to give a general formula, but there is an algorithm to work out these conformal block decompositions for the separate functions F1 to F5. And the conformal blocks that appear in such an expansion are a bit more complicated. So this is only for the experts, but normally you start with a conformal block that depends on U and V, and that depends on the differences of external dimensions, so of the dimensions that appear in the four-point function. And if you want to study these logarithmic CFTs, then you need to multiply the usual conformal blocks by a prefactor that depends on U and V and the external dimensions. And then you can kind of prove a theorem that the most general conformal block appearing in a partial wave decomposition will contain arbitrary derivatives of this whole beast with respect to delta 1, delta 2, delta 3, and delta 4, and the dimension of the exchanged operator delta. And of course, the rank of these derivatives depends on the complexity of the logarithmic multiplets. So if there's a normal field exchange, it doesn't, of course, depend on the derivatives. If there's a rank 2 field that appears in this four-point function, then it'll be a first derivative, and so on and so on. In particular, in this case, F5 has a normal conformal block decomposition, but F1 has a rather complicated looking one. And I'd like to just give one example of such a conformal block decomposition. So in this case, we're analyzing a normal four-point function of a field phi, so that doesn't appear in a logarithmic multiplet, but that appears by itself. So the four-point function will just be a function of U and V. But we're considering here the contribution of a logarithmic field appearing in this four-point function. So it will be some field O1, O2. First of all, we can look at its three-point function. So the three-point function phi phi O2 will be a pure number. And phi phi O1 will be a number with some extra logarithmic term. But still, it depends on two coefficients. Then we turn the crank. And at the end of the day, you see that the conformal blocks appearing to this field, there are two terms. There's one normal term, normal conformal block, with coefficient 2, C1, C2. And there's one derivative of a conformal block with coefficient C2 squared. So in practice, this is enough to look at bootstrap equations. You can just put this on a computer and start working. But to give some intuition, there is one problem with this such a setup, namely that there's no manifest positivity. So in these normal four-point functions, you know that these coefficients are real, they're real valued. So in particular, the square of a real number is always positive. And this is a very powerful constraint on these bootstrap equations. But here, there's no such thing for two reasons. Well, first of all, the theories are non-unitary. So a priori, there's no way to prove that C1 and C2 are real value. They can be complex, they can be pure imaginary. What can you say? And even if they were real valued, if you look at this first term, for example, then it's a product of two different numbers. So one can be positive, one can be negative, and the product would be, we have a minus sign. So there's no manifest positivity in such a case. And this is familiar from other setups. For example, in boundary CFTs, you can write down bootstrap equations that also have these non-manifest positivity properties. And for higher rank, of course, these expressions will be much more complicated, but still the general logic applies. Okay, I hope at least this is kind of all I wanted to say about the general formalism. And at this point, I just want to discuss a few examples. So there's a number of free theories you can construct. In particular, there's a mean field theory that has a logarithmic counterpart. So that gives you one example of a conformal block decomposition. But it would be nice to have some interacting examples as well. And here there's we discovered a nice game that you can play that helps you see something about these logarithmic minimal models. So the starting point of this idea is that you take a field phi 2 comma 1. So in Virasoro theory, this means that it is a level 2 null state, and means that you can really solve its four-point function in a very explicit way. This is an old idea, but it has been applied a couple of years ago by Liendo, Rastelli, and Van Rees as something that interpolates between the minimal models. It's something that you can make very concrete. So it's a family of four-point functions with a continuous parameter, which I call P here. And you can plot this family. So here on this plot, it's a familiar bootstrap plot. So it contains two scaling dimensions, sigma and epsilon. And sigma is the dimension of the field appearing in the four-point function. Epsilon is the dimension of the non-interacting field appearing in its OPE. So this is a family of four-point functions that walks through the normal unitary minimal models, which are the Ising model and its generalizations. And these three people prove that in some range, starting with the Ising model and going up until here, more or less, this family of four-point functions is unitary. So it has positive coefficients, and it corresponds to healthy CFTs. But it turns out that you can push this analysis a bit further in a literal sense. So you can, for example, go below the Ising model, at which point this four-point function immediately becomes non-unitary. For a long while, nothing happens. But when you tune this parameter, well, this scaling dimension to zero, then suddenly you see logarithmic terms appear. And what you end up with is a four-point function that has a single logarithm, but it still respects crossing symmetry. And you can also go in the other directions. You can, for example, push here beyond unitarity and go to critical percolation. So there's a whole line of four-point functions. And at some special points that happen to coincide with these logarithmic minimal models, you get nice logarithmic solutions to crossing symmetry. And it's, this may seem a bit academical, but these solutions are nice for one reason, namely that they allow you to really study the conformal block decomposition. So from now on, we're going to focus on this thing called the triplet model, which doesn't have a normal counterpart in the minimal models. It would be an empty theory. Mathematically, you mean?
Well, is there any simple understanding why you get? Because
in the theory of regardless of this, you mean?
Well, just looking at this picture, is there any simple way of understanding which one corresponds to the replacement theory and which one corresponds to the ordinary?
No, you can understand it not from this plot, but if you look at the solution, then it's a sum of hypergeometric functions. And you know that for special values of the parameters appearing in the hypergeometrics, you can have a hypergeometric evaluated at 1 minus z rather than z can have a logarithm if there's a coincidence, like conspiracy between the parameters. And that's precisely what happens at these points. And it also, so it explains why only for some fine-tuning you get these logarithms. So if you look at the conformal block decomposition of, this triplet model, then you do see that many coefficients that you'd expect to be positive are negative. So this is a telltale sign that unitarity is violated, and there's nothing you can do. Nothing using the normal conventional bootstrap methods. Fortunately, there is some light at the end of the tunnel. There is a rather new approach to conformal bootstrap that was developed by Liozzi and Rago a couple of years ago. And people refer to it as Liozzi's method or a severe truncation method. This is I won't go into the details, but this is a method where you really truncate the spectrum of the theory. So you only take the contribution of a very few operators into account. But still, in many cases, you get very nice results, both for unitary and for non-unitary theories. So this is a successful method in general. And here we applied it to this triplet model, and you do get very reasonable results. Unfortunately, I don't have a plot, since there are no plots yet ready for the prime time. So you have to wait 2 more weeks, I think, before you'll see them. But it does work. So there is some promise, at least in principle, to study these logarithmic CFTs using Liozzi's method. But still, the normal methods are more powerful. So ideally, you'd want to use these conventional linear programming tools to look at these models. And I want to argue that on a case-by-case basis, maybe this is justified. So all of this depends, of course, on these coefficients ci that appear in the conformal block decomposition. Generically, in a non-unitary theory, they can be anything you like. But still, for example, if you look at the ON model, then maybe you can argue on the basis of perturbation theory that they must be real valued. Or in some cases, you can show that many of these coefficients vanish. So if either C1 or C2 vanishes in this case, then the product will be zero. So you don't need to take this term into account. We know in some cases that this happens. For example, in the free theory, most of these OPE coefficients that could be non-zero are actually zero. So there are a lot of fortunate cancellations. In interacting theories, of course, proving such arguments may be more difficult. But if there is such a miracle that happens, then you could use the normal bootstrap methods. And another nice feature of these logarithmic models is that it's very natural to study more bootstrap equations at the same time. So if you look at a system, there are 5 different functions. There will be 5 separate crossing equations. But still, the same OPE coefficients appear in several of them. So F5 is very simple. It only contains very few OPE coefficients. But they feed into the lower functions, F4 down to F1. So you could have a much more powerful analysis if you don't study one of these at a time, but if you use them simultaneously. And there are methods to cope with this situation. So I hope that this at least gives you some message of hope for the future. As a final word, I want to say a few things about holography, because some of you will be interested in this. There's really no problem in studying logarithmic CFTs in ADS. And in fact, it has been done almost 20 years ago. But there are some subtleties that you need to take into account. So you cannot couple a boundary operator to a normal bulk field that obeys a standard ADS equation of motion, because we know the boundary conditions for such a field, and they don't allow any logarithms. So this would not be consistent with the transformation laws that you expect on the boundary. But there is a generalization. So you can couple boundary fields to bulk fields, here phi, with higher order equations of motion. And what happens if you have such a higher order equation, then you can write down a whole host of boundary conditions. And in particular, you expect there to be log z's when you approach the boundary. And in fact, if you do this exercise carefully, then you can precisely match these boundary conditions to what you expect in a logarithmic CFT. Of course, normally, if you have such a higher order kinetic term, then you know that unitarity is violated. But we already expect in logarithmic CFTs that unitarity is violated, so there's no contradiction. So you can study just a non-interacting case, or you can add, say, a cubic interaction in ADS, and that allows you to generate some non-trivial models of log CFT. So for us, this is just a nice playground, because it allows us to reprove all the theorems that we proved about correlation functions and to study study them not only with a single coupling, but often with a whole family of couplings. So in this case, you would have a mass parameter that you can tune to any value you like. So it's a nice playground. But of course, there are also some real-life gravity theories that are dual to such logarithms. I mean, I won't go into them today, but I at least want to point you to a recent review by Grumiller and collaborators who really cataloged all of the known examples. And they live not only in 2D, well, 3D in the bulk, 2D in the boundary, but there are examples that exist for general D. So there's some interesting work to be done, I think. And at this point, I kind of want to wrap the story up. So there are a few take-home messages. The first of all is that logarithmic CFTs are not so difficult. So I hope I convey today that all of the exercises you can do about with normal CFTs simply extend to logarithmic CFTs, and they're just finitely more complicated. So we can, all the local information at least is under control. And maybe the most important lesson is that still the bootstrap applies. There are simple crossing relations that you can write down completely explicitly in terms of OPE coefficients. We know how to compute the conformal blocks, so the whole machinery is set up that you can study any logarithmic CFT you like this afternoon if you want to. These log CFTs are non-unitary in general, so in principle, there are methods to deal with this using, for example, Liozzi's method. In practice, maybe we can even use the normal methods, but if we're lucky, maybe not. Finally, there are essentially two directions you can take this. On the mathematical side, I would say that there are many open questions, easy questions that you can formulate about logarithmic CFTs. One thing is, say, you take a rank 2 field phi with a label phi A, with a label A. Then what can you say about the OPE of phi A, phi A? I mean, does it always contain logarithms? Does it contain logarithmic operators of high rank? Can we bound the ranks of these operators appearing? I mean, there's a whole host of such questions that even in two dimensions is not answered yet. Still, they're very well-defined questions, so we should be able, at least in principle, to address them. And hopefully the bootstrap will be able to tell us something about this. And more importantly for physics, of course, at this point we should start thinking about the landscape of logarithmic CFTs, which is probably much more complicated and rich than the landscape of normal CFTs. For a host of reasons. We have a few examples, as I said before, of theories that were almost certainly known to exist, like percolation, self-avoiding walks in three dimensions. But there will probably be a lot of surprises. And again, there are some natural questions to ask. I think one of the most interesting ones is, are there isolated logarithmic CFTs? So the examples I mentioned can always be obtained by deforming a CFT, so by considering a limit of CFTs and taking some parameter to zero. And it would be maybe even more interesting to have an example of a logarithmic CFT that cannot be obtained this way. So something like the 3D easing model that really stands out as an island in a sea of nothingness. So I hope that in the future, we'll be able to address these questions very precisely. And I hope at least that some of you are motivated to explore them yourselves. Thanks.
So how am I supposed to understand this length scale that appears in all the logarithms? It seems like it's a physically measurable.
Yes, so. Okay, so I think what happens, let's think about it on the lattice, or you would see that. If you change the lattice spacing, then indeed these correlation functions would change. So it is a physical thing. So at some point, you have to kind of fix this scale once and for all and do the analysis at some point. The only thing you know is that whenever you change the scale, there is a kind of semantic equation that predicts precisely how your correlators would change. And it's a very simple equation that just depends on these Jordan blocks. There is a dependence on the scale, and we should not forget about this. So whenever you match with, if you want to match, say, with a lattice computation, then you need to take this into account. That you cannot just change the scale. There is a physically measurable difference, but you don't flow to a different theory. That's the whole point. It's still the same fixed point, but you have to rotate the fields. You have to rotate in field space to obtain the correlator at a different scale. I hope that's reasonably clear. Well, yes and no, in the sense that you can still count the number of Lorentz invariants in such a dimension, and you can count the there. As you know, probably there are more cross ratios for 5-point functions, 6-point functions, etc. But there will be many more undetermined like parameters that are not cross ratios. So they're not. I guess that for 5-point functions, for example, there will not be 5 new coordinates, but more of them. So I don't. My intuition is that there's not a natural generalization. You have to do something more complicated.